Chair calls the Education Policy Committee to order for Wednesday, February 12, 2005. And the committee legislative assistant has noted that we have a quorum, correct? And Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to review the minutes? I call her the editor queen, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have reviewed the minutes, and they look to be in order, so I would move their approval.
Excellent. So moved. We move the minutes for February 11th, 2025. Let's see here. Those in favor say aye, sorry.
Aye.
Aye.
You opposed? All right, thank you. Well, members, before we begin today's agenda, I want to take a moment to go around the table for brief introductions. And if we can keep them fairly brief, just your name, where you're from, maybe one quick thing about you, but we'll try to go very quickly. Let's start with Representative Keeler. And we'll just, are you okay? Put you on the spot here.
Thanks,
and then we'll just go in order, and then we'll do staff after we do members. So.
Sure. Okay. Hi, members. Representative Heather Keeler, District 4A. Just a brief overview. Sat in education for almost 15 years doing Indian education liaison, understanding that support services are very important and have the ability now to try to address attendance as a bipartisan effort with Representative Bakeberg. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Julie Green, representing Edina and part of Bloomington. My background is I'm a public school student. That's where I came from, and all four of my kids have gone up and through the Edina Public Schools. And then I most recently served on the Edina School Board from 2020 to 2020, the end of 2023, most notably during the pandemic.
Hi, thank you. Alex Falconer, 49A, which is Eden Prairie, Minnetonka. I guess the small thing about me right now, I coach our Minnetonka Nordic ski team. Our girls are competing right now at state. I'm clearly not in Bowabic helping them out, but thinking about them and cheering them on.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I'm Josiah Hill. I represent District 33B, which is East Metro, Bayport, Oak Park Heights, Stillwater, up to the parts of Forest Lake. I mentioned our other education committee had the honor of being a public school teacher for the last 25 years. Serving students at my alma mater at Stillwater High, and proud parent of three public school kids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sydney Jordan. I represent Northeast Minneapolis and the part of Southeast Como neighborhood between Como Avenue and Hennepin Avenue, so the upper east side, I guess, of Minneapolis. I have worked as a labor organizer, working specifically with educators, across Minnesota, but also in Minneapolis. And I have served on both the Education Finance and Education Policy Committees throughout my career here at the legislature, but this is my first year as the DFL lead on this committee. So happy to be here with all of you, and I'm proud to represent Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Patricia Mueller down in Austin, Minnesota. I have, in the surrounding areas, I have Austin, Blooming Prairie, Lyle, Grand Meadow, Southland, some Hayfield kiddos in there, two private schools, Sacred Heart and Pacelli. Public school, school teacher. I've been kind of all over the place for the last 20 plus years. And don't have any kiddos, but have a my husband and I have been married for almost 21 years. He's also a school teacher turned pastor, and we have I don't know if that's good or bad, but and then I have two dogs, Lincoln and Reagan.
Representative Tom DePell from the Cottage Grove and Hastings area. I likewise graduated in 2000 from the public school system. The board chair and founder, co-founder of a school in Woodbury as well. We've got six kids and look forward to serving on this committee.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Marge Fogelman. My cities are Worthington, Windham, St. James, and Jackson. This is my second term, first time on the education, so I'm looking forward to that. Product of the public school. My kiddos went to K through 8 at our Christian Day School, and they finished in the public school in Worthington. So I am very much looking forward to learning more about our education system.
I'm Jimmy Gordon, first-time representative, District 28A. That's most of Isani County, part of Chisago County. I've got four kids. My oldest is eight. My youngest is two, so we stay pretty busy at my place. And we do homeschool with the oldest two, and I'm looking forward to serving on this committee as well.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. My name is Brian Lawrence. I serve House District 27B. That includes the cities of Princeton, Zimmerman, and St. Francis. I've been blessed with four children, and my youngest is now a senior. So we're going through the senior last things of the senior year for him, and so really enjoying that. I've was blessed to be able to serve on the Truancy Committee this summer as well, and learned a lot as being a part of that in the process. I get to serve on both the Finance as well as the Policy Education Committee. So glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Drew Roach. I represent District 58B, which covers Dakota, Goodhue, and Rice counties. Father of three, and look forward to getting better policy here and working on the Education Policy Committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bierman, would you like to jump in quick?
First, thank you, Madam Chair. Apologies for being late. Robert Bierman, Apple Valley, 56A, been in the legislature. This is my fourth term, second time on education. I was here some years ago, the first term, and glad to be back and ready to dig in on ed policy. Thank you.
Yeah, and then let's do staff, and this time we'll start with Ms. Para. I'll do me last, and then we'll go this way with staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Christina Para from Arts Research. Nonpartisan staff, happy to help with all members on any researching or bill drafting you like on any education policy topic.
Jody Withers, Committee Administrator for the House Republican Caucus. I serve both the Education Policy Committee and the Education Finance Committee.
Tom Brennan, House GOP Research.
My name is Isaac Pilon. I've been with the Republican Caucus since November, and I'm excited to serve as the Committee Legislative Assistant.
Wilson Lee, DFL staff for Ed Policy.
Mark Beltrandi Redquist, DFL staff for the Committee and Education Finance.
And Leah Trillian, IOD, from Alex Healing for this committee, as well as the
Another page. All right, did I miss anybody? Okay, well, I'm Peggy Bennett. I represent 23A. I live in Albert Lea, southern Minnesota. About 2013 or 14 or so, somebody knocked on my door. I was happily a first grade teacher, and somebody knocked on my door one Saturday afternoon and asked if I'd consider running for office. And my first thought was, are you crazy? But here I am, and I'm actually enjoying it. It's very good, and it's fun to see education from a different standpoint. I taught elementary school for 33 years, some special ed, mostly first grade, though, and loved it, still do love kids and love teaching. So good to be here with everybody. We've got a great team all around the table and those who can't fit at the table, too. So one final item, members, in your folders, you have a copy of the committee rules and procedures, and they are also posted to the committee webpage. So now I'm going to ask Representative Lawrence if he'll come take the gavel, and I'm going to move to the testifier table and ask Rep. Mueller and Rep. Bakeberg to join me. Let's see, I'll get some of this stuff out of the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm honored to be able to chair the Policy Committee meeting today, and thank you for coming before us with your presentation. Please introduce yourself and make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm Representative Peggy Bennett, 23A. And, Mr. Chair, I move House File 6 before the committee to be referred to the Education Finance Committee.
Okay. Let it be noted that Chair Bennett moves House File 6 to be referred to the Committee on Finance Education. Madam Chair, would you proceed with your presentation, please?
Thank you. And members of the committee, thank you for hearing this and taking it under consideration. I'm just going to go over some parts of House File 6, and Representative Mueller and Representative Bakeberg are also going to help with this. So I'll just start out by saying House File 6 covers several of the education priorities for the House Republican Caucus for Education. This bill makes it clear that literacy is learning, local control is innovation, and empowered parents are engaged parents. It's divided into three articles. They are presented here together, but it is our intention that these proposals will also be introduced and heard as standalone bills. And anybody who knows me knows I don't care for omnibus bills too much, so I'm happy that we're going to do that. In Article 1, start with that, we focus on our commitment to the foundational literacy skills, reading instruction delivered through the science of reading. And in a minute, I'll have Representative Mueller, who's been a leader in our caucus for literacy and reading instruction. She will go through this article in a little more in depth. Article 2 focuses on empowering parents with information and promoting education innovation through local control and flexibility. Rep. Bakeberg is going to use his real-life experience both as a teacher and administrator, and we'll talk more about that article. So we're actually going to jump to Article 3, and I'm going to go over that one, and then we'll kind of go backwards from there. So in Article 3, we provide flexibility for school boards in both funding and relief from the more than 65 new mandates that were imposed upon our schools in the previous biennium. This last article has two sections. So Section 1 allows for flexibility of funding through fiscal year 2029, which would be the 2028-29 school year. Under this section, school boards would be allowed to transfer any funds that are not otherwise encumbered or limited by federal law, so long as that transfer does not inadvertently trigger additional state aid or increase local levy. Section 2 of the last article allows for mandate relief also through 28-29 school year. And under this section, school boards would be allowed to delay implementation of the many new mandates that were imposed in the 23-24 school years. And I'll briefly go over the general categories of those mandates. But before I do, I'd like to say that a couple weeks ago, we had a huge number of school personnel in this room talking about the impact of the various mandates on the schools and their desire actually to implement a number of them, but also especially for the READ Act, just wanting to implement that with fidelity. And they use the word fidelity a lot. They're feeling very overwhelmed right now, both financially. We know that many of our districts are going into debt and are going to have to cut teachers and staff and other things, programs, as well as just inundated with trying to implement so much. So Article 3 is addressing those very needs that schools are crying out for. So the mandates that allows for this flexibility, and again, doesn't mean districts won't implement these, but it does give their school boards an option to say, hey, let's put the brakes on this one for now while we implement these and then move on. It's totally up to those districts. The mandates include the 2023 Early Childhood Omnibus Chapter 54, 2023 Education Omnibus Chapter 55, 2024 Education Policy Omnibus Chapter 109. Mandates included in the 2024 Education Finance and Children and Families Omnibus Chapter 115. The Paid Family and Medical Leave mandated under 2023 Chapter 59. the earned sick and safe time mandated under 2023 Chapter 53, or any amendments to these laws that were enacted during the 23-24 biennium. In either case, whether flexible funding or mandate relief, the school board may adopt their action by resolution at a public meeting. These will be community decisions. They will not be done in the dark of night, like we sometimes do here. They will be done through public meetings and with public input. There are some mandates I don't like, and there are some mandates I do like, and I'm speaking personally. But I believe in local control, and local control is empowers local decisions and also respects local decisions to adopt or not adopt the mandates that I like or don't like, and that's part of trusting our schools. We offer these options for funding and mandate flexibility in the near term with the expectation that we as lawmakers will take some time and think hard before imposing any new mandates, but also consider seriously revising or repealing some of the existing mandates. I think we just bit off too big of a chunk for our schools to handle. So thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd like to ask you to recognize Representative Mueller to explain Article 1, and then Representative Bakeberg, who will explain Article 2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point in time, I will recognize Representative Mueller. Would you please introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Representative Patricia Mueller from 23B, and I'll be going through Article 1. So if you have your, sorry, always a teacher, if you have your bill in front of you, you can start at the very beginning, and we'll just be looking at Article 1. Article 1 provides revisions to the Reed Act as enacted during the 23-24 legislative biennium. Let me just pause before I go any farther. We have heard after our first go around at this, I've had teachers come to me saying, look, this was a fad. You don't actually want to do this. We're letting you opt out. That is not true. Currently, how the law is written, it's impossible for our schools to comply with. What we're doing here is we're trying to revise it so that they're actually able to do it with fidelity. Anyone who comes to me and says that I don't want reading taught in school versus that by the science of reading is lying. All right? So, Article 1, the last 2 years, we found out that there is a bipartisan consensus that the whole language or balanced literacy approach to reading has failed. And after years of deception, the reading charlatans have been exposed and their fraud has been revealed. We have heard from lots of places all over the country that the type of reading strategies that have been put forth by teacher prep programs and by curriculum authors have been not only not working, but have actively worked to not teach students how to read. While the Reed Act has acknowledged this is a real problem, it is quite simply overregulated and underfunded. I want to acknowledge the good faith work that was done, put into the Reed Act in the last 2 years, but I also want to acknowledge that the 24 session essentially began a Reed Act rollback, which we hope to rectify this session. To put it simply, Article 1 begins with our commitment to the science of reading and its fundamental belief that every child has the right to read. You will find that on line 1.25 all the way through line 2.23 if you're following along. We will stand firm on that commitment. We will not soften language to appease people. We will call it for what it is, and we will make sure that not only our teacher prep programs, but our teachers are being trained with fidelity in the science of reading. We have heard from our schools that the Department of Education and their partnership with the Center of Applied Research and Educational Improvement, also known as CARI, has been limiting, to say the least. It has been difficult with this collaboration, and this process was made worse by new misdirected political goals embedded into the law that distract from our focus of foundational literacy skills. Therefore, This bill will end the partnership with Cary starting June 30th, 2025. It will direct MDE to take up their primary role in assisting schools. Starting in line 5.11 to 5.13, we repeal some of the new requirements included by the 2024 session that have political or ideological purposes, not for actually teaching in the science of reading. And then in lines 9.21 through 9.23, we restore the expectation that teachers are not only properly prepared to provide reading instruction grounded in the science of reading, but we reinstate the assessment to verify this. And I want to be very clear, this assessment, if you look at 9.21 and 9.23, it says, an examination or performative assessment of knowledge. So don't be misdirected. Don't be deceived. We're not talking about absolutely paper pencil tests. It can be also a performative assessment, but that we need to be an independent mechanism and a measurement so that we know that when the teachers come into the classroom that they are prepared. I want to be very clear in the changes that we're doing with the READ Act. We understand that along with our students who were deceived in how to learn how to read, our teachers were deceived on how to teach how to read. And so under no fault of our teachers, they were teaching something that was not effective. The fault belongs to the people that perpetuated this lie and has continued to be taught in our teacher preparation schools. And so we want to make sure that we are going not only helping our teachers to be retrained and get them new curriculum, but we want to go upstream and looking and auditing our teacher preparation programs so that we can ensure that they are teaching in the science of reading as well. So that when someone like Mr. Bakeberg has to hire teachers, he doesn't have to then retrain them as well. Let me put this bluntly. Literacy is learning. And when we provide a child with the foundational literacy skills, we empower children to become lifelong learners. This is a foundation to how we thrive in our society and in becoming adults and contributing citizens of our society. Our democracy demands a literate society. And that means that we need to be holding fast to the science of reading. And Mr. Chair, I would like to ask that you would recognize my colleague, Representative Bakeberg. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. At this point in time, I will recognize Representative Bakeberg. Would you please introduce yourself for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ben Bakeberg. I have the privilege to represent the communities of Prior Lake, Jordan, a portion of Shakopee, and then those are the school districts I represent, and then I also represent Southwest Metro Intermediate District as well. So professionally, for those of you that don't know, in my normal life, when I'm not here, I'm a middle school principal. I've been an educator for my entire life. So education is something that I'm passionate about. But more importantly, I'm passionate about kids and helping kids find their gifts and talents. So Article 2 is amply titled Educational Innovation because it focuses primarily on empowering local school districts to be innovative and meet the needs of their local district. I think it's important that we understand the needs of Prior Lake are very different than the needs of Pequot Lakes, and we need to give those local districts the autonomy to make those decisions. Currently, this is accomplished by identifying and revising certain programs that empower and enable schools, but they come with the caveat that the school must seek permission from the Commissioner of Education in order to do an innovative program that will meet the needs at their local district. This revision shifts the mindset from one of schools meekly seeking approval from the department to ones of trusting our locally elected school board members, educators, superintendents, parents, and community members. When those stakeholders are at the table and are making decisions about what is best to meet their local needs without the heavy hand of bureaucrats, great things can happen in our schools. And those of you that serve on school boards or have served on school boards, I'm sure you've seen that when when you're getting creative. So there are three pieces in this article. First, we will direct the Department of Education to create a school performance report that is user-friendly. That's really important. So think about the reports that come home for your kids, and how many of you are like, what does this mean to me? Mm-hmm. It's user-friendly with the expectation that the end user, whether it be educators, parents, community members, it's understandable to them. MDE has a lot of really good data on the online data center and their school report cards, but the information is oftentimes difficult for normal people to understand. Speaking as a principal, it's oftentimes sometimes difficult for me. Maybe that's more of a something I shouldn't admit. Simply put, we want educators and educators, parents, community members to have easy access to the critical metrics of student performance, the areas of reading, math, science, attendance, and graduation for where it's appropriate. I think back when I was getting my master's degree, one of the classes talked about all of the responsibilities that are placed on educators. And this was, you know, close to 20 years ago. And so it was in the 90s, was using this example. They went back to the 50s, and the growth in expectations on schools, it was unimaginable at that time. It was a huge discussion point. But if we did that same thing today, and really what happened in the last 2 years, we are putting a weight on our schools that is unattainable. We've heard from superintendents. We've heard from teachers. We've heard from educators across the state to please just help us focus on what we want to do, and that's teaching kids. I want to make it clear, these are not report cards. We're not grading schools. We want to give educators, we want to give community members, we want to give parents the information they need in order to make informed decisions. Because those of us that are educators, we know that when parents are engaged and empowered, the kids will be more successful. When families and educators partner, if you hear nothing else from this conversation, I hope you hear that when families and educators partner together, kids win. Second, this bill identifies a variety of current statutory and session law programs like experiential and applied learning opportunities for students or innovation zones, and they put the planning and decision making into the hands of educators. We trust educators to make decisions that are best. It takes that responsibility away from the commissioner. We also identified several current innovation programs buried inside of 124D and move all those programs into a new chapter of law known as educational innovation. This is just the reason for this is simply to inform current districts of the laws available to empower them to be innovative in their districts. Most school districts don't have time to dig through and reference different areas of law to give them the authority to do something. Third, we convert the current Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Center within the Department of Education to be an office of achievement and innovation with a very simple and direct message: to assist school districts and charter schools in researching and implemented practices focusing on academic achievement in literacy, reading comprehension, mathematics, numeracy, science, and career readiness. This mission comes with one key limitation: all opinions and guidance issued by the Department of Education are advisory and not binding on a district or charter school. We believe in local control. This new Office of Achievement and Innovation will also serve as a clearinghouse for nonprofits. Far too long, members of this committee and Education Finance, which I was part of both of them last session, we have decided which nonprofits should be funded, which nonprofits schools should work with, and that needs to shift. School districts need to be the ones making that decision. We need to shift the dynamic to empower school districts to determine which nonprofits might be helpful to their local community, and to have the Department of Education conduct its due diligence to avoid nonprofits that are shady and want to take advantage of our school districts. I leave you with this. Local control is innovation, and partnerships are critical for the success of our students. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is Article 2.
Thank you. There we go. Now we can speak. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Mueller, Representative Bakeberg. Appreciate your introduction of your bill at this point in time and the motion that you've made. If you each would grab a seat behind the presenter's table there, we've got several. Oh, sorry. Representative Bakeberg, you get to stay.
No, Bennett.
Oh, I'm sorry. My first time at this, sorry. Madam Chair, if you would stay at the table, I would appreciate that. Since you are the author of the bill. We have several individuals that have given us or signed up to testify today. As far as our guests that are here to testify, I'll be calling on you two at a time and also give the next two in line so you can be prepared to come for your presentations. When I call your names, come up to the table to present and, excuse me. And just so you know, we are going to be timing this. We're allowing 2 minutes, so be aware of that. Isaac's going to help us time. He has flashcards here to give you an idea of where you're at as far as the timing goes. And so I'll introduce each of you and ask you to come forward and introduce yourselves as well and the organizations that you will be representing today. And so to begin with, our public testifiers are first Brandon Lunick and John Magus. On deck are Denise Dietrich and Scott Kronquist. And Mr. Lunick, I'll ask you to go first. Introduce yourself, please, and who you represent.
Thank you. I'm Brandon Lunick, and I represent the Moorhead Area Public Schools, and I'm also here to represent Shannon Hunstead with the Dilworth Public Schools, who's our neighbor just to the east. So we're here to specifically say thank you for allowing us to be here today to testify on behalf of House File 6, specifically Article 3, Section 1. We want to emphasize the importance that we believe granting independent school districts the authority to internally transfer funds to areas of need. This flexibility is not about asking for new money, but rather using existing resources more effectively to meet the needs of our students and communities. For both the Moorhead Area Public Schools and the Dilworth Glendon Felton Public Schools, the flexibility would mean the difference between financial stability and potentially having to go back to our local taxpayers for an operating referendum, perhaps a capital project levy, or perhaps even further reductions than what we're projecting, at least on the Moorhead side. Passing this legislation might prevent other school districts from across Minnesota to do the same. If our school board was given the ability to make these transfers, I just want to highlight four big areas that we believe it would benefit. We believe that allowing us to move these dollars to areas of need would reduce the number of staff reductions heading into future fiscal years. We also believe that it would continue to support academic and operational programs that support our students and staff. We also believe that by doing this, it would allow us to stay on schedule with our curriculum cycle or any other purchases that we have through capital projects. And number four, it would also help stabilize or grow our unassigned fund balance. Each of these crucial points that I just shared all have a direct impact on our classroom. The 23 and 24 legislative sessions provided much needed funding for our school district, but many of those dollars didn't directly reach the classroom. So, in closing, I'd like to illustrate the need for this legislation and at the same time emphasize to you that each school district has its unique financial challenges, and this bill does a lot to ensure that each district can allocate resources in ways that best serves its students, staff, and community. So I thank you today for your time, consideration, and I urge you to support this common sense fiscally responsible measure to empower local school districts to manage our resources effectively. Thank you.
Super. Thank you for being with us today. Just a note for our representatives, if you have questions, make notes of them, and we'll be taking them after all the testimonies given. Next, we have John Magus.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm John Magus, Superintendent of Duluth Public Schools, and I'm here today to talk about critical budget challenges that are facing our district and many others, and to advocate for additional resources to implement the READ Act in Minnesota schools. Additionally, I would like to voice our support for House File 6, which would provide essential funding and mandate flexibility to districts across the state. Duluth Public Schools is committed to providing high-quality education to all students in our district. However, like many districts across Minnesota, we face significant budget challenges. Just this past week, we displaced over 40 employees. Rising costs for transportation, special education, and other essential services have placed an immense strain on our general fund. At the same time, state funding has not kept pace with inflation or increasing expectations placed on our public schools. These financial pressures directly impact our ability to hire and retain staff and maintain facilities, as well as to provide resources that our students need to be successful. This situation is further complicated by unfunded or underfunded mandates that require us to divert limited funds from critical areas. This lack of flexibility leaves our district, like ours, in a very difficult position, where we're forced to make painful trade-offs that ultimately affect student success. The READ Act represents a very important step towards ensuring that every Minnesota student has effective literacy instruction. We strongly support the goals of the READ Act, but its successful implementation requires significant resources that many districts, including Duluth, currently lack. Specifically, the READ Act calls for us to use evidence-based literacy practices, which demand investment in professional development, curriculum updates, and additional staff support. Without adequate funding, these critical components cannot be implemented effectively, and the goals of the READ Act will remain out of reach for many students. We urge the legislature to allocate additional fundings to support implementation of the READ Act. These investments are essential to closing literacy gaps, supporting struggling readers, and to prepare our students for long-term success. Pardon? Yes. Yes. We are also very supportive of File 6 because we need the flexibility so that we can use our decision-making at the local level through representation of the school board, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for joining us today. Next up, we have Denise Dietrich and Scott Kronquist. On deck is Francis Wittenberg and Miriam Eagle. Denise Dietrich, if you'd go first.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, which serves all 331 school boards across the state of Minnesota. Today, I am also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the Minnesota Association of Business Officials. Together, our organizations are responsible for the administration and the fiscal oversight of all the school districts in the state of Minnesota. There are three provisions in this bill that I would like to speak to today. First, under Article 2, Education Innovation, I would like to point out that our organizations have long advocated for policies that would promote education innovation. The Innovation Zone program is one step in this effort, allowing some school districts who have the time, talent, and resources to implement new education models. However, we would like to urge the committee to expand the Innovation Zones program by authorizing the local district to define instructional hours for all high school students. This change would allow students to earn credit and for schools to retain the funding for personalized education experiences rather than the traditional seat time requirements. This statewide systemic change would empower districts to design more engaging and relevant high school experiences to better prepare our students for their futures. Secondly, under Article 3, titled Funding and Mandates Flexibility, this provision allows school districts to transfer funds between operating accounts. And this is really important at a time when many of our school districts are facing spending cuts. This provision's flexibility will provide some fiscal relief without requiring additional state funding. And it recognizes that local school boards and superintendents are in the best position to work with their business officials to determine and allocate resources where they are needed, whether it be mental health support, career and technical, implementing the READ Act, high costs of energy, transportation, and otherwise. So we do support this provision. And then the other is the third item that I would like to address today is the would be the relief from state mandates for the school years 2025 to 29. Our school districts are compliant in nature, and they want to implement all of the mandates that they that the legislature has asked them to, but they need additional time and flexibility. So we are asking for this additional time in order for our school districts to implement the requirements with fidelity. Thank you.
Thank you as well. Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and appreciate the time to offer a few comments. And I am going to focus on Article 2, the innovation article, in my comments. Members, when our superintendents and school board members get together, I'd say that when they get the most engaged and most excited is when they start to talk about reimagining education, what it could look like, how it needs to look different. And in fact, it's not just school leaders, it's students. We had a policy conference this last fall, and we had an amazing student panel that offered their thoughts on what they would like to see in terms of changes to the school experience. One of the young women looked out at the audience and said, "I understand it's probably been a few decades since many of you have been in a high school classroom." Well, she wasn't wrong about that. And she went on to say, the schooling experience today does not look that different than it did 100 years ago. She also wasn't wrong about that, at least not completely wrong. So clearly there's a desire for doing things different, and we think the Office of Innovation and Achievement and the Innovation Zone expansion in this bill could go a long way towards helping us get there, overcoming some of the obstacles and the structural barriers. And we also think it could be a huge factor in addressing the chronic absenteeism issue that we're seeing today. I know Representative Bakeberg and Representative Keeler have done great work in this area, and we think making the school experience more meaningful, more relevant to our students would be one big answer to helping address that issue. So I will stop there, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, proceed. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Thank you for the opportunity for me to speak today. My name is Frances Wittenberg, and I'm a proud parent of three awesome children. I am a retired veteran and someone who is deeply invested in the academic success of all students. I strongly support the revisions of Minnesota's House File 6 bill, and I believe it is a critical for the future for our state's education system. As a former professional military education instructor, I understand the importance of adapting lessons to meet the diverse needs of students. This is a principle we must apply in our classrooms to ensure that all students' unique learning styles are addressed. House File 6 focuses on empowering educators to tailor their instruction to meet those needs is crucial in giving every child the opportunity to succeed. One of the aspects of House File 6 that I'm particularly passionate about is emphasis on the science of reading through the READ Act modifications. When we moved to Minnesota 5 years ago, my youngest daughter struggled with reading and continues to receive additional support. But thanks to the dedication of her teachers, her reading interventionists, and staff and principal at Lakewood Elementary School in ISD 709, She has made remarkable progress. House File 6 commitment to the science of reading will ensure that all students, like my daughter, receive the structured support they need to succeed. Additionally, I fully support this bill provisions allowing school districts more time to implement state mandates that support student outcomes and the flexibility to allocate funds as needed. This will ease administrative burdens, giving teachers more time to focus on what matters most, teaching, and ultimately improving student outcomes. In closing, I urge you to pass this revisions for House File 6. This bill supports our teachers, strengthens literacy instruction, and ensures that every child in Minnesota has an opportunity to succeed. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to the positive changes this bill will bring to our education system.
Thank you. Miriam Eagle, are you present? Last call. Okay. Kat Briggs and Sydney Perez. Kat Briggs, would you go first?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Kat Briggs, and I am a school bus driver for Independent School District 196. I'm so grateful that education support professionals like me have access to unemployment compensation in the summer. I have the same basic economic security as my sons who work construction pouring concrete when they cannot work in the winter. Driving a school bus is not an easy job. We're basically driving a one-room schoolhouse through traffic. It is extra tough in the summer, and not just because there's no air conditioning. During the summer, I work 2 hours in the early morning and 2 hours more in the afternoon, 4 days a week. That's only 16 hours of work, and of course, there's no work the weeks where there is no school. Because of unemployment insurance, the weeks when there was school, I got partial unemployment benefits along with my wages. The weeks when there were no routes, I got my full benefit, which is about half of my weekly school year income. That little bit of economic security meant that I didn't have to choose between taking care of my kids at school, and when they're on my kids, as some of you may know, they are my kids when they're on my bus, and my grandbabies. My husband and I still have to be careful with our money. He's a farmer. Unlike other summers, I'll be able to drive to my son's place in Kenyon and help with my grandbabies there without worrying about affording gas. Growing up, I had the same bus driver from elementary school through my senior year in high school. Peggy, bus 39, knew my name, where I lived, what my schedule was. She took me to and from school each day, as well as driving me to various athletic events and field trips. She was great. It's critical that we have the best people like Peggy to transport our most precious cargo. Our kids, children, need consistency in their lives. What better way to show consistency than to have the same bus drivers, chaperones, paras, food service, and other staff year to year? It is no coincidence that the fall after the UI law change was the first time in a long time you didn't hear about the back-to-school staffing crisis in the news. It's easier to retain staff, especially new drivers, and fill hard-to-fill jobs like summer school, now that school workers won't be asked to go from financial crisis to financial crisis with no safety net.
Please wrap up your comments.
Laws like unemployment, earned sick and safe time, and paid family and medical leave were more than lip service. Minnesota showed us that you value us and the work we do. As a conservative myself, it is difficult to see my party trying to undo that. I thank you all for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck, we have Aaron Sandsmark and Kulia Pringle. And right now, we've got Sydney Perez. Perez, you correct me.
Kind of like virus. I mean, why not? Thank you for allowing me the time to speak today and share some insight. My name is Sydney Perez. I'm a school counselor. I'm also an advisor of our National Honor Society, as well as our Native American Student Alliance. And then outside of school, I serve as our chair-elect of the Minnesota School Counselors Association. And so the content of this bill is important to me, not just at a local level, but also at a statewide level, where I am partially responsible for ensuring that all students in the state of Minnesota receive school counseling support. I know our hearts are in the right place with HF6 and that understanding around local control. However, as a school counselor, I have strong concern over the provisions allowing school districts to opt out of the recently enacted state education mandates. This measure will threaten educational equity by creating a system where some students receive essential protections and programs while others do not, depending on their school district's choices. State educational mandates are designed to ensure that all students, regardless of background, zip code, receive a high-quality education. Allowing districts to opt out will widen existing disparities that already exist, particularly for students that are already underserved, including students with disabilities, students that speak multiple languages, and low-income families. Recent mandates have strengthened literacy instruction, student mental health support, and culturally responsive teaching. In some districts, if they were to choose to ignore these policies, their students will be left out without critical resources that are available to students in other parts of the state. This inconsistency undermines fairness and sends a message to our students that some are less deserving of high-quality education than others. Additionally, this bill will create uncertainty for families who move between districts or expect a consistent standard of education statewide. A patchwork system of compliance erodes trust in public education and weakens our ability to provide every student with the support that they need. Education policy should prioritize student success over district convenience. I urge you to consider the concerns in this bill and to put forth all Minnesota students, regardless of whether they're in your district or not. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we got Aaron Sandsmark, Kalia Pringle, Teresa Greniger, thank you, and Carrie Johnson are on deck.
Hello, committee members, committee chairs, members. My name is Aaron Sandsmark. I'm the Coalition Manager for Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. I'm here to testify today to share my opposition, my very real, very serious concerns about House File 6. I'm here to provide a voice for the families, students, and organizations that are a part of SNS. I urge you to truly consider the catastrophe that would be House File 6 if allowed to pass. The provision in Section 2, which is my primary concern, line 22.16, where school districts will be allowed to opt out of the education mandates passed in 2023, will do immense damage to our children. Mandates like access to Native Indian education, ethnic studies, and so much more would be affected by this bill. But for us at SNS, in particular, the K-3 dismissal ban and the ban on seclusion for our youngest learners would be put in jeopardy. If these mandates came down to district choice, we know that given the opportunity, school districts will absolutely opt out. I want to talk about the mandated ban on pre-K through 3 school dismissals. This mandate was put in place because our most vulnerable communities have been consistently pushed out of classrooms at a disproportionate rate. Minnesota has huge equity gaps in our outcomes, and these mandates are an attempt to right the wrongs we have done to these children over and over again. They were put in place to provide protection to our communities. House File 6 would do incredible damage to children and families who have been affected by the overwhelming statistics of school pushout, expulsions, and physical restraints. Our communities will have to fear again for the well-being of their children because school districts will decide if those protections are worth their time and their bottom lines. The data has shown over and over again that suspension, seclusion, school pushout, and restraints have been used the most in our Black, Indigenous, and disabled populations in Minnesota. Districts utilize these so-called tools, often out of convenience, perpetuating biases found statewide. Just look at the data. I urge this committee to not move forward on this bill, and it completely undermines the progress and protections we have gained since 2023. Please reconsider House File 6 for the sake of our children in Minnesota.
Thank you. Kalia Pringle?
Yep, good job, Chair. My name is Kalia Pringle. I am the executive director of Stand Up Minnesota Parents United. I'm also an educator by trade. I am taking a break from the classroom to focus on families. I'm here today as an advocate for families and students who rely on our public education system to be fair and accountable. I'm here to express my strong opposition to House File 6. Particular areas of the bill, not the whole bill, specifically Article 3 and Article 2, the portion of the bill that would do away with the Office of Equity I'm all for our Office of Innovation, but not at the expense of equity. This section of the bill would undermine protections that were hard fought and won in 2023. Provisions like the pre-K through 3 suspension ban and the exclusion ban were put in place to protect our youngest and most vulnerable students, many of whom are Black, Indigenous students of color, and those with disabilities. These laws were necessary because too many children were being pushed out of classrooms instead of being supported within them. If districts are given the chance to disregard these protections, many will, and history has shown us that the students who need the most support will be the ones left behind. Families across Minnesota have fought for these protections because we know what happens when they are not in place. Children as young as 4 years old have been suspended for behaviors that should be met with care, not punishment. Students with disabilities have been secluded instead of given appropriate interventions. We cannot allow districts to pick and choose which students they will protect and which laws they will follow. House File 6 is a step backward. It puts the interests of institutions over the rights of students. I urge you to reject portions of this bill and stand with families, educators, and advocates who believe in an education system that serves all children fairly and equitably. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Teresa Greninger. I don't know if you got that one right. Carrie Johnson. On deck, we got William Schwant and Dr. Justin Killian.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Teresa Greninger. I work as a paraprofessional at King Elementary in Deer River, which is about 3 hours away. I drove to St. Paul today to strongly object to HF6, which could take away my unemployment insurance, earn sick and safe time, paid family and medical leave, and other programs that make it possible for me to do my job. Despite being some of the lowest paid employees at the school, paraprofessionals play a vital role in supporting students' academic and social growth. I teach essential skills like reading, math, and social skills. For example, we took one student in 2 years, went from not knowing his letter sounds to reading 70 words per minute thanks to our dedicated efforts. I've been a dedicated paraprofessional at King for nearly 12 years, and I've witnessed significant changes. Our team has dwindled from 35 to 19 paras across departments. We struggle with retention due to the low income paraprofessionals earn. However, recent legislation has allowed us to collect unemployment for 3 summer months. This has been a lifeline, encouraging some staff to stay and attracting new talent. Because school workers became eligible for unemployment insurance during the summer months, I was able to prorate my pay from 9 months to 12 months, giving me a $300 difference in my pay every 2 weeks. And with this increase, I still barely make enough to pay my bills living in low-income housing. If I'm not able to take advantage of unemployment insurance, I'd have to find another way to make ends meet, which would mean forgoing my work at King. I've talked to 5 other paraprofessionals who had said they would have to do the same. The biggest victims of any disruption in paraprofessional benefits are the kids. The students I work with need the individual attention and paraprofessional can provide. Jeopardizing our financial support systems does more than jeopardize our jobs. It jeopardizes our children's future. If HF6 passes and school districts take the opportunity to repeal unemployment insurance for school workers, our retention issues will continue to worsen. I urge you to vote against HF6 to protect paraprofessionals and ensure kids have access to the vital services they deserve.
Thank you. Gary Johnson.
Hi, my name is Carrie Johnson. I was born and raised on the Leech Lake Reservation. I work at a border high school, Deer River High School, which is 80% population Native kids. And I work with level 3 EBD students. So as you see, I'm wearing boots today. I wear these all day at work because I got flight risks. I have elopers. I got kids. You never know what I'm going to do at school. And unless you can take a day off and come spend it with me, you're not going to understand how vital we are in that role. The unemployment is a big deal. I am a single mom of 2 girls, and in the summer, finding out right now that there's a chance I could lose my unemployment in the summer and have to find full-time work plus childcare for my kids that are 8 and 11 years old, that's detrimental to me.
and it's detrimental to the work that I do. I have students that text me at 5:30 in the morning, are you going to be in school today? They won't go if I'm not there. Like, it's a trickle effect, and it starts obviously with finances, but this bill, HF6, specifically Article 3, needs to be picked apart a little bit more before it's passed, please. Because we're already hurting for paras, our wages are horrible, and even the principal, I spoke with him yesterday, and he did state one of the biggest pushes that he uses to get paras into our building right now is the fact that we offer unemployment. We are at a legal, pardon my French, shit show right now because there are students that are sitting in rooms not getting gen ed classes at all because they are required by their IEP to have one-on-one, and there is nobody to take them to class. And it starts with the financial part. We're pushing. We're up for negotiations to try to raise the pay, but Article 3 specifically affects us financially. It's a big deal. I really appreciate you guys giving me your time, and if anybody's going up to Red Lake, Lake of the Woods for a long weekend, and you're there Monday, Tuesday, spin in, do an hour or two with me at the high school, I would really appreciate it. Anybody?
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony today. William Schwant, Dr. Justin Killian. On deck we have Todd Karish, and Laura Carpenter.
Good afternoon. My name is William Schwant. I'm a special education paraprofessional at Poplar Bridge Elementary in Bloomington. I'm also the local president for the Bloomington Federation of Paraprofessionals. I'm here to testify against House File 6. By and large, House File 6 speaks about increasing student achievement. There's not a parent, educator, or taxpayer in the state that would disagree with that. Where I have concerns is Article 3, Section 2 of this. This allows school boards to pass a resolution to not comply with new state education laws and new state education rules. Among the education laws and rules identified are paraprofessional development, unemployment insurance, and hourly school employees and paid family medical leave. This will not only directly affect paraprofessionals, but it also will affect students. Paraprofessionals spend each day working directly with students. In many cases, students with whom paraprofessionals work are the youngest and those who need extra help and attention to reach their fullest potential. Paraprofessionals come from many walks of life, and the majority do not have the experience to address the disabilities, learning challenges, behavior challenges, or the process, or possess the knowledge of best practices to help teach students. Allowing school districts to opt out of providing meaningful professional development for paraprofessionals is bad for not only paraprofessionals, it's bad for students. It is absolutely contradictory to the majority of what House File 6 hopes to accomplish. Paraprofessionals are near the bottom of the pay scale, and as of today, the Economic Policy Institute estimates that to maintain a modest yet adequate lifestyle for a single person in the metro area requires a yearly income of $50,000 a year. For districts outside of the metro area, the cost of living isn't much less. Compared with the fact that the median yearly earnings for a paraprofessional in Bloomington is still less than $30,000 a year, and we are one of the better paying districts, unemployment is vital to making sure that paraprofessionals can make ends meet.
Please wrap up your comments, please.
In closing, I'd like to say we cannot continue to allow school boards to balance their budgets on the backs of the hourly school employees that make school happen on a daily basis. And I ask that further detail and attention is paid to Article 3, Section 2.
Thank you. Dr. Justin Killian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm actually here to read the testimony of Ramona Springus-Doss, a special education teacher in District 196. Thank you for allowing me to speak today on behalf of the most vulnerable students in the state of Minnesota, that being the students who receive special education services and the educators who serve them. I also stand here today to oppose House File 6, Article 3, Section 2, that permits a district and school board to ignore any laws and regulations passed during the 2023-2024 session, so long as they post it to their website and let the commissioner know. If passed, this would bypass all the tremendous work we did over the last 2 years to rein in the abuse of using Tier 1 special ed teachers. We were not in federal compliance, and we fixed that. Because of this legislative body, Tier 1 special education teachers cannot manage IEPs. And why? Because they aren't trained to. And these are legal documents between a family and a school district to make sure our most vulnerable children are receiving the services that they are required to receive. I would like to remind this body that we have a special education teacher retention crisis. And I say retention, not recruitment, retention, because for every special education teacher in a classroom right now, there are at least two special education teachers not working in education with an active license. So that's what's going on to the profession. And if we allow school districts to return to the process of hiring Tier 1 special education teachers at will and providing them no training and no support, we're going to be back in the same compliance issues that we were, and we're going to be putting our most vulnerable students and our most vulnerable classrooms at risk. That is why we ask that you oppose House File 6 and please keep special education teachers and special education students in your mind, and we ask you to please do not support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Todd Karish, Laura Carpenter, and then Roshi Lee, who will be following them.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Todd Karish. I am a high school social studies teacher at Farmington High School. I teach individuals, and we look at how individuals and nations make choices on how to use their scarce resources to fulfill their wants and needs. Specifically, I get to jump into some economics. The success of any education system depends on the quality, commitment, and well-being of its educators. From the teacher in the classroom to the educational support professional, to the nurse, to the custodian that cleans rooms and buildings. I'm concerned about two portions of this bill that I read, allowing charter schools to create their own assessments of standards. As we know, schools are vastly different, but we are creating an unfair system to grade schools under this plan. Traditional public schools have to take the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Test. Charter schools under this bill would be allowed to make their own assessments. Private schools do not have any assessments. Are we really going to give a summative grade to schools when some schools have to take the hardest tests? Charter schools make up their own tests, and private schools just give themselves an A. I'd also like to talk mostly what is not included in this bill. As schools face increasing challenges in recruiting and retaining qualified educators, it is crucial to implement strategies that attract new talent while supporting and sustaining the existing workforce. To build a strong pipeline of educators, we must enhance the appeal of the teaching profession. This includes offering competitive salaries, providing financial incentives, and wanting to keep people in the profession with a strong retirement pension. Addressing issues such as student behavior, administrative burdens, work-life balance is also essential in preventing burnout and attrition. At our local school board meeting on Monday, just happened, there was a projected cut of a health assistant to our middle school nurse. That school serves 863 students and another 50 to 60 staff members. So far this school year, that office has logged 5,369 office visits. How do you attract someone to an underpaid job with an immense workload? Ask your current educators how many of them are recommending their kids to join your profession. My son, soon to be graduating from high school, when contemplating future choices? No way, Dad. I encourage you to listen to the folks in the profession and draft legislation that focuses on recruitment and retention and target the incentives that matter most to improve our system. Thank you for listening, and thank you all for your service.
Thank you. Laura Carpenter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Laura Carpenter. I am an organizer for SEIU, and I was a food service worker. And today I'm actually here as a mom of a kid who receives special education support. I'm concerned that the changes allowed in this bill would negatively impact my child. For most of my kids' education, they had to say goodbye to the para that they had grown close to and formed a deep bond with when the para left for a summer job and wouldn't be coming back. I had gotten used to my kids starting the summer with 4 hours of crying and being consoled as they lost these folks that they got so attached to. Because of unemployment insurance, the summer of 2023 was the first time in Cypress's education that they didn't have to say goodbye to their para at the end of the school year. In fact, their para actually signed up to work summer school and specifically supported Cypress throughout the summer as well, and she was able to access unemployment insurance during the weeks when summer school wasn't available. Over the 2 years where Cypress had the same para, they made a ton of progress, both academically and socially. These are important jobs that make a difference in kids' lives, and it takes special people to do them well. How do you individualize education to a student's needs if you don't know the kid? My kid's IEP is long. And because of the staffing crisis, paras are working with many kids whose support needs are just as complicated. Before the legislature passed paid training for paras, it took months for a new para to get in the groove. Para educators work bell to bell, and before the law change, a para's first day was also the student's first day. There was not time to learn all the different supports, interventions, and personalities, and the 6 hours in current law actually isn't enough. You should be expanding training rather than making it optional. Paras need more than 8 hours a year, and every caring adult in the building should get professional development every year. I was a nutrition worker who wanted to be culturally responsive to support the kids' individual needs, provide the appropriate behavior interventions, but we were never trained on any of that stuff, and yet we were still the first person to interact with a dysregulated kid on a regular basis, just figuring out how to do our best. Laws like unemployment, earned sick and safe time, and paid family medical leave, paid training, that this bill rolls back makes it harder for caring and talented adults to choose to do this important work.
Can you please wrap up your comments?
Yep. If you roll back these supports, kids across the state, including mine, are going to suffer. Thank you.
Thank you for coming today. And to all of our testifiers, thank you for making the trip. Oh, yeah, you're right. We've got one more. Sorry. Premature. Mr. Doshuni, welcome.
Always a pleasure to be the closer. Appreciate the order. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Adoshuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. First, I want to be clear, MDE always remains open on partnering on improvements to our education system, but I do want to highlight some concerns we have with the proposal in HF6, and I appreciate being able to connect briefly with Chair Bennett on some of those. First, we have serious concerns about the fund transfer and relief from mandates proposal in Article 3. Allowing all of our local education agencies or LEAs to individually choose which law to follow and not to follow could create a confusing patchwork of different expectations from school to school and district to district. We risk losing a lot of oversight and accountability for the use of state funds and consistent expectations around the education we provide to Minnesota students. For example, what would this mean for students and families in the areas like consistent provision of school meals, literacy, charter school oversight, finance accountability reforms, non-exclusionary discipline, English learner services, advances for American Indian students, and compliance with the authority of our Office of Inspector General investigation on AIDS and grants, as well as just MDE oversight and monitoring. MDE would find it extremely difficult to offer guidance on the infinite possibilities of fund transfers and decisions to not follow particular state laws and rules. This would result in significant confusion and result in compliance issues as well as possible liability for our LEAs making these decisions. How impactful and meaningful would other proposals in the bill related to the READ Act and the performance reporting system be when LEAs have a vastly different set of expectations? This may set a troubling precedent. Second, I want to make clear our deep concern with eliminating the funding for our EDI center. This funds the work of dedicated professionals focused on a number of areas critical to our students, including supporting comprehensive mental health, school safety, achievement and integration, school nurses, discipline, restorative practices, physical health, social and emotional learning, and bullying prevention. The EDI Center also administers and manages many grants that school leaders who have already testified about the lack of funding rely on to offset costs around student achievement and safety. Eliminating the funding for these hardworking staff will ultimately have a dramatic impact on our students, staff, and families statewide that they tirelessly support on a daily basis. And I'll just briefly mention, we'll share some concerns offline around some of the language in the READ Act And then just around the Office of Achievement and Integration, I would say that our Compass team is hard at work on a lot of the expectations set for the Department of Education. And we do believe that a lot of the components in the performance reporting system are included in the current reporting system, but we can have conversations about what that looks like and possible additions to that. But those would carry a cost going forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. That concludes the list of testifiers. For all of you that came today to testify, thank you for making the trip to St. Paul, coming before a committee and sharing your thoughts and your concerns as well. With that, at this point in time, I'll invite Vice Chair Mueller and Representative Baker back to the table. We're going to open it up for members' questions. I don't have a list before me, so but representatives, as you have questions, Representative Green.
I thought you said you had a list. Chair? I thought you said you had a list, Chair, but...
No, I was looking for a list, the only thing I didn't have.
Oh, okay.
So well, you get to be first.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Chair. I appreciate that. Thank you so much, representatives, for the presentation on this bill. I have two areas that I have questions and some significant concerns on with this bill. I'm going to start with Article 3. And, you know, a little bit of background, too. So I served on the school board for 4 years, right? I understand local control, but I also understand accountability. And what concerns me about Article 3 is it seems to eliminate the accountability piece, and that is concerning. And I can't quite measure up, and this is where I'm getting to my question, how... In Article 3, if we're saying that districts can opt out of all the laws that were passed, which includes the READ Act, are you concerned that districts would opt out of the READ Act? Because there's no accountability there unless I'm not reading it right. So that's the first part of the question. And then the second part is, I heard the word delay. I heard that used in explaining Article 3. What does that mean? Does that mean that the work... And the expectations are delayed and state law is delayed, or is it opting out completely and they don't have to do it at all? So those are my two questions on Article 3.
Thank you, Representative Green. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. Good questions, and I did hear, you know, opt out and repeal in some of the testifiers, and then again here. I don't believe the word opt out is here anywhere, but it does allow school boards to delay implementation, meaning they can look at, there were 65 plus new mandates that were put upon our districts. You can't, they cannot do this well or with fidelity with all 65 mandates, more than that actually, and get that done well. So it allows them to prioritize and say, okay, shall we focus on the READ Act and this, this, and this first, and then, and do it. Just like you would in the classroom, you cannot take on all of those responsibilities and expect to do them well. So this gives them the opportunity to delay implementation. Very different than opt out. And it doesn't let anybody opt out, and eventually, unless we change it as a legislature, they will be doing all of these things, because it changes the timeline. I'll let Representative Mueller just touch briefly on the READ Act component of that. But the other thing is, you talk about accountability. Do we hold schools accountable for their inputs or their outputs? I propose that we hold them accountable for what we're holding them responsible for, the outputs. How are the kids doing in reading, math, science, all the areas that we cover as schools? We hold schools accountable in that area, but we give them the flexibility to locally educate the children the way their children need to be educated, and it's different throughout the state. So I believe giving this flexibility allows great accountability, because it allows schools to teach the kids the way they need to be taught, and then we hold them accountable through their results.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, you have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. So the way that I am looking at this is that if they and I appreciate you saying that there is no option to opt out. So you do have to still follow all the laws that were passed. Is that, that's correct? I just wanted to understand that because the laws from the past, yeah, the laws from the, I'm sorry, for the past biennium. So like in the READ Act specifically, so districts would still need to implement the READ Act. It's, you're just delaying some time and giving more time. Is that what this says here? Because I'm looking between 22.18 and 22.21. It just seems that that could just continue to be delayed and that work would not get done. That's my concern.
Madam Chair, or Representative Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. Again, with what, piggybacking off of what Chair Bennett said, it is not an opt-out. Schools have already started to implement this. What we're saying is with this delay, they're able to now implement it with more fidelity. And if we're able to get them more money, we're actually able to really help them get them implemented with fidelity. We do not believe any school is sitting there saying, whew, now we don't have to teach any kids how to read. Like, no school is saying that. Every school that we've talked to has said, we love this expectation. We love that you've asked us to do this. We love that you have given us now some guidance on how to do this. But you've underfunded and you've over-mandated all the little bits that we can't actually do. The way the law is written now with the timeline that it is unable, like schools are unable to comply with it. So this isn't an opt-out. This is a delay. So that's actually done with fidelity. And I should, it should be very duly noted. And if you talk to almost any school district in our state, they've already started doing this. And the struggle is, how do we make sure to implement it with fidelity? Thank you, Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, if I might add.
Madam Chair.
Just briefly, and you talk about, so in line 22.21, it says for the length of time established in the resolution. We heard from districts, they want to do the majority of these mandates when they're able, but we have to allow them to establish a timeline. Some might say, you know what, we're going to do this bunch of mandates, and this is the deadline 1 year from now. We'll do 2 years from now for these and allow them to do it well. There are dates here. It is not an opt-out. It is delaying implementation according to each school's timeline that they choose, and they might not choose to delay at all. It's up to them.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Can I just ask, do my second question too? I appreciate hearing that, that all the progress that we made is not to be eliminated with this bill. So that's great. The second thing is I want to just talk about, I'm concerned about the elimination of having literacy materials that are culturally and linguistically appropriate and responsive for kids. In Minnesota, we know we have a very large achievement gap. That is proven. The data will show that. We have studies up and down. And so my question is, what research is done or to say that the elimination of this is good for kids and kids of color that struggle with reading?
Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green. As a person who has done lots of research on this, and we know that equity has to start with literacy. And the science of reading doesn't necessarily mean that you can't use literature from other places or from other spaces. Differentiation is different. Differentiation means I'm going to still teach the same concept, but using something that maybe is more representative of my classroom. I did that all the time, but I didn't change the outcome of the standard I was trying to teach, which is we're trying to teach kiddos how to read. Whole language or balanced literacy with this idea of culturally responsive didn't teach students how to read. Let me repeat that. Didn't teach students how to read. And if you want our students to have equitable and equality of opportunity, it's got to start with teaching them how to read. The science of reading is a proven method that allows a teacher to teach someone how to read. And I would like to say that if you don't have that, I mean, there's lots of people who would struggle with, oh, what books we should do and whatever and all that stuff. If you don't teach them how to read, it doesn't matter, because then every book in front of them, you know what I'm going to say, every book in front of them is banned. Every book is banned when a child doesn't know how to read. So differentiation is different than making our literacy instruction less effective with this idea that we cannot, not, and I'll just say this, and thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I have done now a review of almost every READ Act equivalent of all the states that have done that, and the curriculum that they have approved. There's curriculum that are nationally recognized as science of reading. They're able to teach the science of reading. That curriculum, which is some of the most nationally recognized and are used in so many different places, and that our school districts are choosing to use, but they cannot get reimbursed because it is not approved through MDE. And we don't know why, because there's no metrics that tell us why. And so this type of emphasis is something that we as teachers can do with through differentiation, but it cannot lessen the effectiveness of the science of reading. So that's why I am not concerned about what you're referring to, because I know that qualified teachers are able to differentiate and put that cultural responsiveness into their lessons without losing the fidelity of science of reading.
Representative Green, follow up?
Yes, please. Respectfully, I disagree, because I think the input, and I want to focus on the inclusive piece to how we work with kids, is vitally important to growth. I'm going to use Representative Bakeberg's words earlier about having user-friendly reports for parents, right? User-friendly in a form that they can relate to and understand. That is the same concept here. And you can look back at how curriculum has come through, and it has not been designed for students of color. It just hasn't been. So that is why in Minnesota we have made this a priority. And so that is concerning to me, because it kind of wipes out the idea that we would look at kids and differentiate and give them the tools that they need to be successful. We give kids the tools they need to be successful by providing the teachers the tools that they have. And so that is my concern. So that's just my follow-up. But I would just, I'm not in support of H6 how it is. I think there's a lot of barriers that are put in here for students. And so that's my comment.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, can I just say one thing, please? I hope that you and I can have conversations about this, because I'm really excited that we'll be able to work together on this. I would say that while you're concerned with a school curriculum not being created for students of color, I would like to say that Mississippi, who has way more students of color than we do, decided to stay with the science of reading. They don't take this, what you're talking about, and every student got higher on reading. Every student did. So we are seeing it working in other places. We are seeing places that are still holding fast, that are not using the same language, because this type of language allows our students, or allows teacher prep, not our teachers, our teacher prep programs, to not focus on the science of reading. So we are seeing it work in other places with just as much diversity that we have here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller. We've got Representative Keeler. Yeah, you're next. You made the list.
That wasn't a very long list, I guess. Okay, thank you. I do want to start by saying, you know, I like to work bipartisan on these efforts. And so I just want to ask a couple questions in hopes that, like, we can have ongoing conversations to get to a good place. And so I'm going to follow Representative Mueller's teacher thing, and if you have your bill in front of you.
I do.
I kind of want to follow up with Representative Green and what she said on that line 633. We talked about this last year a lot, the mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors idea. And I can tell you, as an Indigenous person, it does matter who we see reflected in, you know, in our stories. And Representative Bakeberg, remind me of your three R's quick. It's relevancy, relatable, and...
rigor, relevance.
Representative Bakeberg.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I got you in trouble. I didn't mean
yeah,
to.
Yeah, take me to the...
Representative Bakeberg, your three R's.
Give it again. So it's rigor, relevance, and relationships.
Okay, so I think...
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. And I... Representative Bakeberg and I have been in a lot of spaces lately, and you say this a lot, and I want us to challenge that you striked out culturally relevant and then to reflect diverse populations. And I think when we talk about relevancy and relatability, and we want kids to feel seen and loved and valued in our schools, like, I just want us to be mindful of how we can navigate that, because it is really, really important, not only for me to see me in stories. And to be clear, like, my kid wants to read because there are more Native specific kids or books out there. It does make a difference. He does want to read longer. He was more engaged. And so I want to be part of that conversation too, because I really, really, really think it's not only beneficial, you know, for us to see us, it's beneficial for you to see us. And so I want to say that and hope that we can really work on that a little bit forward. The second piece I have is Article 2. I think that's a Representative Bakeberg area. One, I obviously love that we're putting attendance here and know that we have a lot of really good bipartisan bills to do that. I am really concerned that it's at the cost of the Office of Equity for very clear reasons. Can you, Representative Bakeberg, just explain to me what components of the Office of Equity we would be eliminating or the role that they provide for us by moving it to this new office?
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And I share your passion. You know, making sure that education is rigorous, is relevant, and it's done where we're building relationships with kids. So I'm going to just be very blunt in this conversation. So I think it was, so my first administrative job, I was the district assessment coordinator in Mille Lacs. And I had zero clue what I was doing. And I walked into my office the first day. The high school assistant principal walked in and said, hey, you and I have to go to an MDE training about being the DAC. It's district assessment coordinator. And I was like, oh, okay, great. I showed up there, and the opening line from the MDE trainer was jokingly, we're MDE and we're here to help. And I was having a conversation last night with a superintendent who is extremely frustrated about the response from the department on a whole host of issues. So the EDI Center, quite bluntly, has focused on many divisive things that schools are saying, we want to teach kids. We want to help kids achieve. We want to help school districts. We want school districts to be innovative. But what I have experienced professionally and what I have seen from my colleagues is significant frustration, specifically from the EDI Center. We want, educators want, I won't speak for myself, but what I've heard from educators like yourself is that we want to talk about hard history and want to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We want to have those conversations. But what this EDI Center has done is drive a more divisive narrative, and we have lost our focus on what really matters for kids. And when kids feel the curriculum is relevant to them, when it's rigorous and it's taught by someone that they have a relationship with, the kids will flourish. So that's the purpose of the Office of Achievement and Innovation, to help kids find their gifts and talents and go with those three R's.
Representative Keeler, follow up?
Yeah, I'm going to have a couple follow-ups, just because I'm sorry.
Okay, one for right now.
So what did you say?
He said, I'll give you one for right now.
Well, I at least got two, okay? So I maybe want to just ask if we could consider, you know, shifting it to more of this, like, education, innovation, and inclusion space, right? Because the thing is we want every single kid, right, as, like, the native queer kid in the classroom, how am I included in that space? And I think that that's really important because we say all the time we want every single kid to feel loved, valued, and seen. And I think that that's that when you talk about being included, you're not just tolerated in a space. And so I would challenge us that maybe we think a little bit down that lane. I'm with you. We have room to change and grow, but I would do that. My last area is Article 3. And again, for like people that have the lanes in front of me, it's 2210 through 2214. I get really, really nervous here. And this is playing out pretty lively in my community, that there is a large, and back to like even the local control piece, individuals in my community have a major issue with the lack of transparency on how our schools are spending their funding. And so before we allow a school district to just maneuver money around, how are we going to be able to make sure that there's like a public audit or a public opportunity for people to engage with how our school is spending money? Like, if you're not spending your money appropriately, it doesn't matter how you move your money, you're still not spending it appropriately. Or if you're adding different levels of administration that's not needed, right? The community should have some engagement in that, especially because our school districts tend to go back to our community to ask for levies to invest in these changes. And so is there any area for this part of the transitioning and moving money to add a level of transparency to make sure that we're effective and efficient, and that we have some sort of mechanism to say you may not be spending your money well, and maybe actually what you need to do is remanage your money rather than move your money? So I don't know which one of you maybe want to answer that, but then that will be my last question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Keeler, I agree with you. Transparency is hugely important. And our local school boards, various boards do better and some do worse at that, something they all need to work on. But I, excuse me, I will read to you, starting with line, I believe, 2210, the school board must adopt a written resolution outlining the purpose for and specifying the amount of funds that are transferred under this section. A school board must post the resolution for each approved transfer on its website and must transmit a timely electronic notice of each approved transfer to the commissioner. These will be done in public meetings, just like school boards make other decisions with public input, because they do allow that at their meetings. So this is done publicly. It is not done in private in some back room where they're shifting funds around. This must be done publicly. It must be posted publicly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Keeler, follow-up?
I do have a follow-up to that. I hope we can have a further conversation about that, because I've really been trying to dig into this. And I get concerned that the language says a school board must post a resolution for each approved transfer. The point is that what we're saying here is that your school is saying they don't have enough money as a whole. This resolution makes me think that the only thing you're going to put in front of us is the money that you want to move. I think what I'm asking is we want to look at a school district as a whole and how they're spending their money. And right now, it doesn't really seem like there's a mechanism for us to do that. And so that's just what I want to say. Like, I can't support this bill in the way that it is, but I hope you do know that, like, I'm really interested in diving into these areas and think that it's important that we address these concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. For the sake of time and termination of the committee here, we do have three other representatives that are requested. I guess I would encourage you to seek out the Madam Chair at some point in time and ask those questions. I'm going to come to lead Jordan for any final comments before our meeting concludes.
Mr. Chair, we're at final comments right now. We have 20 minutes left in the hearing.
I think we're supposed to go 4:45.
4:45.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Otherwise, I'd be happy to go on.
Mr. Chair, that is sort of my point. We are examining a very large omnibus bill as our very first bill, and I know I also really don't prefer omnibus bills either, but it does seem like there needs to be a lot more time, and this also does need to go to other committees. I know it's going to Ed Finance, which I appreciate because they're a financial issues here. But my question is to Chair Bennett. What other committees will this be going to? And will it include stops in both children and families in the Labor Committee?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once it goes to Ed Finance, then Representative Kreshaw will send it off from there. So I guess I'll most likely defer to him. It could very well go to other committees, but that will be up to him as he sends that off.
Thank you. So it doesn't seem like we know the bill path of this bill. It does need to go because of the like implications to ESST and PFML and other labor standards. It definitely needs to go there. It also has impacts on our early childhood. I have a number of questions, but realizing our timing, some of my biggest ones are how they relate to other aspects of our education law. And one of them is the opting out of unemployment insurance or UI. If a school district does decide to opt out of providing that UI to their hourly school workers, would that put the state out of compliance for federal UI regulations?
Madam Chair.
I believe I would defer to Ms. Para. Would you have any thoughts on that?
Ms. Para.
Chair members, I think we would need to consult with the department. They provide a lot of technical assistance during when the unemployment insurance bill was being developed and going through committee.
Thank you for your comment. Madam Chair.
Further comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say, and that's some information we could perhaps get for the future, but I will say that, you know, we've heard from many local school officials we've heard from MDE, we have only $33 million left in that UI account right now. We know that's not enough. It'll get us through maybe one more summer. With the looming deficit that we have no idea how much money we're going to be put into that. So if that account is empty, that benefit becomes a huge unfunded mandate on our schools. It's going to drain resources from classrooms. I understand the passion that the employees have over that. It's something we can continue discussions on, but we have to look at the realistic fact that it's going to have huge impact on our classrooms if we're not able to fund this, and we may not be able to. We're headed towards a deficit. Puts us in a tough situation of wanting to do what we can, but maybe not being able to. So we can have further discussions on the other impact.
Lee Jordan, final comments.
Well, Mr. Chair, federal regulations require that workers in all broad categories be treated the same for UI. So if workers in Roseville are eligible for UI, but workers in Rosemount are not, that would make this bill in violation of federal law. My other concern is that this bill before us is in violation of the Minnesota Constitution. You know, Article 13, Section 1 of the Constitution states it is the duty of the legislature to establish general and uniform system of public schools. What this bill does is eliminate in statute that uniform standard. Schools need to be uniform. That is what students require. That students need to know, and parents need to have that knowledge that their school is going to be following state laws. If schools are creating a patchwork, that not only makes it difficult for parents and difficult for students, who, by the way, were the source of those laws that were passed last year. Those laws didn't just come from Representative Bierman or Representative Hill or Representative Jordan. They came from students and families and educators who are saying this is what students need to succeed in our schools. So not only does this bill need to go to many other committee stops, I'm glad it's going to Education Finance at least, and I'm glad it's going to be coming back in the form of several other bills, but as written, this bill is in violation of federal law, it's in violation of the Minnesota Constitution, and it is not ready to become anywhere near Minnesota law. So I would urge a no vote on House File 6 as written. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee Jordan. Final comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say that House File 6 affirms our commitment to the science of reading and addressing the literacy crisis, empowers our schools and parents through local control and innovation, and provides much-needed funding flexibility and mandate relief with the ultimate goal of educating our children. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would request a roll call.
Okay, a roll call vote has been called. Just want to reiterate, the chair renews the motion to refer House File 6 to the Committee on Education Finance. That's where the bill is slated to go next. And so we will proceed with a roll call vote. Isaac, would you read off the members? Do the roll.
Chair Bennett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Lee Jordan.
No.
Bierman.
Bierman, no.
DePell.
Aye.
Falconer.
No.
Fogelman.
Yes.
Gordon.
Aye.
Green.
Green votes no.
Hill.
Hill, no.
Keeler.
No.
Lawrence.
Lawrence votes aye.
Roach.
Aye.
The bill prevails. House File 6 prevails to be passed on to Committee on Education Finance, 7-6. With that, I believe our business is concluded today. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 18th. With that, the committee stands adjourned. Thank you all, and thank you to all those that came today and be a part of our committee meeting.